Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. at 1904 East Main Street in Urbana. Online at quaker.org/urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking with poet Jeannie Murray Walker. Jeannie, can you hear me all right by phone?
I can.
Talking with us from your home in Delaware, I believe. Pennsylvania?
It's in Pennsylvania, right. And I'm delighted to be with you again, Steve.
You teach at the University of Delaware, but you drive back and forth from Pennsylvania.
I do, and Delaware is such a small state that it really only takes about 45 or 50 minutes to get back and forth.
And I remember you have a poem in your current book, New Tracks, Night Falling, where you refer to an incident that happened on one of those drives.
Well, I actually write a lot of driving poems, I guess. You tend to use metaphors from your own experience, and I love to drive and do it quite a lot.
In your new book, you begin with a foreword of your now seven books of poetry. Is this the first one where you've had a prose foreword? I don't remember. I've read most of your books, but I can't remember if you've had others like this.
It is. It's the first preface to a book of poetry that I've written, and I wasn't thrilled about the idea of writing a preface. It's something that the press did with all of its books of poetry. So the editor asked me if I would write a preface, and it was after I had put the manuscript together. And she was an enormous help in putting that manuscript together. So it was actually during the process of putting the manuscript, ordering the poems in sequence, taking some of them out, and putting other ones in, and I was writing the preface. And I came to believe, after having written it, that it was a very good idea. The cover of the volume shows a snowy field with some trees, and there are tracks leading off into the darkness. And it feels to me as if the cover leads right to the preface, and then the preface leads right to the poem. So it feels okay. I'm glad there's a preface.
Now, this book is published by Erdmans, and was it your last book that was published by the University of Illinois Press, or was that, am I forgetting one in between?
Yeah, no, that's right.
A Deed to the Light was University of Illinois Press, and now this is Erdmans. Now, your editor at Illinois didn't ask you to do that, I take it?
Most books of poetry right now in the United States don't have prefaces. I think part of the reason that Erdmans wants its poets to do that is because the people who tend to order books from Erdmans, the community that tends to use that press is a community that's not as familiar with poetry. And starting with prose and leading people towards poetry is probably something that's useful for that community. Generally speaking, university presses, which are the main publishers of poetry, there are a few trade presses, and there are also some independent small presses, as they're called, that publish poetry. But those presses tend to not use prefaces. They don't introduce the poems in any way. The poems either sink or swim on their own.
Would you be willing to read a poem from your new collection over the air, and we'll let listeners hear your poetic voice now that they've had an introduction to your conversational voice?
Sure, I'd be delighted to.
What would you like to read?
Well, there's a poem in the first section, or the second section, actually, it begins the second section, called Adam's Choice. It is about what Adam must have thought about waking up and discovering that he never chose Eve, that she just appeared. And the difficulty of his maybe coming to terms with that. So this is Adam's Choice.
This is read by Jeannie Murray Walker, the author of this poem, and it's found in her new book, New Tracks, Night Falling.
It must have been a windy night like this, the trees swaying and hissing, tossing their hair in desperate gestures, when he broke out of the spell and realized it wasn't fair. He never chose her. When he woke up, she stood before him like a bright goblet filling up with water. He was thirsty. How splendid it can be to drink when you're thirsty, was what he thought. He was that young. Now he realizes there is a stain spreading on his heart, that the name she gave the yak chafes him, and she sings off key. He never chose her. He'd like to grab his knife and cut off her song. But rain is slanting down, and she is running toward him, her eyes terrified under the bending, cracking maples. And a curtain pulls back in him, and he takes her into his arms and begins the long journey toward learning to love what he's been given.
The poem Adam's Choice from Jeannie Murray Walker's new book, New Tracks, Night Falling, just out this year, published by Erdmans. Jeannie, when you selected these poems for this particular collection and then you ordered them in a way that begins with separations and then choices. You talk about the divisions between people, and I thought your preface explained very well why you did that. But tell our listeners a little bit why you made that choice of the order in which you placed poems in this collection.
Well, I think in this collection the idea was to go, I mean, my sense very much was after, I suppose it was after 9/11, that there were divisions between people more rampant than I had seen them in this country since the 1960s, maybe. And I became quite worried about them. It wasn't a kind of political science judgment I was making. I really worried a lot about the rich and the poor, the divisions between the rich and the poor, the sense of the poor getting poorer, the sense of some people being on the inside and some people being on the outside, the old and the young, part of it driven by technology, part of it driven by the sense that we needed to separate ourselves as a nation because we were in danger. And so I had written some poems about that, and I think it's really very difficult to write poems about politics or poems about poems of complaint like that, and I hadn't done that much in the past. But I ordered the book by putting those poems first and following them with poems about responsibility or human choices. What kinds of choices can we make to try to mitigate those differences and those distances and those separations? Can we? Is it even possible? And so that's the middle part of the book. And the end of the book leads to a kind of tentative resolution. I don't think it's incredibly positive, but I do think it is about taking steps of faith, possibly being able to believe that it's possible to mitigate those kinds of separations. So that was the order of the book. It's really a kind of journey. It's a kind of emotional journey.
We wanted to talk on this program also not only about the poems in this book, but how they represent parts of your own personal spiritual journey over your lifetime as a writer. You began writing very early, and on an earlier radio program here, you talk a little bit about how you began writing and how young you were when you first started. But your mind has changed a bit over the years. My sense is, from reading your poetry and from hearing you talk before, tell our listeners a little bit about that journey as a start.
Well, you asked me to think a little bit about this, and I have. I think, in some ways, the journey actually started for me when I was about 16 or 17 years old. And I'm not talking about writing poetry now. I'm talking about some kind of realization that I didn't know everything, that it was necessary for me to find out what it meant that there was such a thing as God, or what it meant, what my relationships with other people meant. I was born into a fundamentalist family and had a kind of activist father who started a school that I went to. There were four kids in my grade. There were about 20 of us overall. And that school now has 4,000 students in it, by the way. It's K through 12. But that was in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I was held in place by this wonderful fundamentalist community that was very warm and loving.
And this was fundamentalist Christian.
Yes, uh-huh. It was, absolutely. And at the age of 16, I was sitting in bed doing my homework, listening to something on the radio, probably Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley, the Kingston Trio. I don't know what it was, but I realized at that moment, I don't know what made me realize this. It was like a moment of deconversion. I suddenly understood that I didn't really know. I couldn't know. I had been raised with the sense that you could know who God was, exactly what your relationship was in the world. It was all about certainty. And I realized at that point, I got up out of bed, got dressed, went out, walked around the streets for about 2 hours. It was raining. It was moist. It was spring. There was, you know, the smells of flowering trees were in the air. And I think that was the moment when the journey began, the real journey about trying to figure out, what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to be a believer? What does it mean that there is the world that's separate from me and that I have to come to terms with it in some way? And it's not about my family coming to terms with it. And that, of course, led to the great separation from this incredibly close community that I had been connected to. And I left it. I left it very soon after that. I guess it was about 2 years after that I left it and began a voyage which was really quite lonely. But fortunately, there were many other people that I met along the way who were on the same kind of a journey. And it was very exhilarating. And all of a sudden, I was open to surprise and open to a lot of ideas, a lot of reading poetry and the possibilities that were involved in talking to people and thinking with people. And so it was both a loss and also an incredible opening up of possibility for me.
You talk about the separation from that early fundamentalist Christian community. You're leaving it by choice. In this current book, New Tracks, Night Falling, you start off with talking about separations and choices. Were any of those memories conscious to you as you were putting this volume together?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I have always been deeply affirmed by community. I am by nature very communal. I love talking to people. I love eating with people. I love having family together. I love, the notion that you're with people. And so it was really jarring and difficult and a grief to me that I lost that community, because although the community was not one that I could belong to anymore, you know, as soon as I understood that things might not be the way I thought, I was no longer part of that community, really. And it was a similar reaction that I was beginning to have, I think, after 9/11, the sense of whatever community we had in the United States, and I think it's difficult because we're a melting pot, but that community seemed to be slipping away. So they were similar experiences. I don't know that the one triggered the other, or, you know, I'm not sure how they were related, but I think empathy and connection is what is what holds us together. What keeps us in place, and that's what a lot of my poetry has been about, I think.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Jeanie Murray Walker. Jeanie is spelled J-E-A-N-N-E, Murray M-U-R-A-Y, and Walker W-A-L-K-E-R, about her new book, New Tracks, Night Falling, and about her own personal spiritual journey. Listeners are encouraged to call in and ask a question or make a comment. The numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, where the program originates at the University of Illinois, the number is 333-9455. Elsewhere, if it's a long-distance call, punch in 1-800-222-9455 for a toll-free call. Happy to have people join the conversation. Jeanie, when you're talking about leaving your early community of fundamentalism, what was the hardest thing to leave? Because there were obviously good things about that community, as well as things that the certainty that you felt wasn't appropriate for you.
Well, you know, there was a phone chain. And I knew that phone chain well, that if you were in some kind of trouble, and that could include losing a job, needing some kind of hospitalization, having a car accident, any kind of trouble that you were in, people, the whole community suddenly would know it. And people would bring food, and people would call, and there was truly a kind of brother and sister mentality, and I think people would come over and sit with you if you needed it. Now, I had had experience with that because my father died when I was 13. And my mother, of course, was struggling to take care of three children, and the people in that community were enormously supportive and warm, and there were potlucks. People would get together and bring these wonderful dishes, Midwestern, you know, kind of everything was white, but it was so good. Macaroni and cheese and hot dishes, as we used to call them in the Midwest, and meatloaf and Kool-Aid and, you know, that kind of thing. And we would have these potlucks, and the kids would all play together, and the parents would talk, and we were really raised as one another's brothers and sisters in some way. And to give that up, which is what really I needed to do, although I was growing out of it anyway and going off to school, to college, but I never belonged to a community that was that warm and that supportive. And, the fact I couldn't belong to it anymore, I didn't belong to it anymore the minute I realized that all this may not be certain, because it was a realization that I'm not sure a whole lot of people in that community had. I don't know. But I did, but these things were very difficult to give up, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about another poem you might have selected to read. I ask you to have a three or four for us to read on the air. What one would you choose next?
Well, let me choose the poem from the book that has been selected to appear in Best American Poetry 2009.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. It is a real honor. This is called Holding Action, and this poem is really based on, and it's the last poem in the volume, and it is based, I suppose I learned about writing a poem like this from Geoffrey Chaucer. It's kind of ironic because he was writing around 1300. But he has at the end or the beginning of Troilus and Cressida, which is his long poem, a poem that says, that speaks to his book, and it's absolutely wonderful. It says, "Go, little book, go into the world and be safe and take your place. And don't do any more than you're supposed to, but don't do any less." And it is so passionate. So the whole question of will these things last, you know, will these poems last? And when you put a book in the world, what is going on really? So this is called Holding Action. Letters be the memory of this moment. Ruth's three-legged golden lab sniffing for news beneath the hedge, grass glittering with rain, the bird feeder mangled by our car. Years from now, I want to remember how we walked the splendid earth and saw it. When children read this and smile at its old-fashioned vision, then words, stubborn little boxcars lugging meaning across the rickety wood bridge to the future. Hold, hold. Couple against time. Bear the red geranium, the slender birch, you sentences. Glitter against the massive dark of nothing. Tell of feet that buff this door sill till it gleams. Of cartwheeling children. Remember the Rosetta Stone, the hum of Xerox machines. Remember monks copying, how a prisoner in solitary picked up a pebble to scribble stories on the wall. Letters, I tell you, even if your paper yellows in the attic, even if it's torn and thrown into the sea, each of you separate from your brothers, swim through the ocean, row across the sky, walk through the wasteland, find a reader, stay together, hold.
We've just heard the poem Holding Action that begins, "Letters be the memory of this moment," read by the author Jeannie Murray Walker, that was selected for Best American Poetry 2009, and it's also found as the last poem in her new volume, New Tracts, Night Falling, published by Erdmans, just out this year, 2009. I might remind listeners that these programs are archived, and if you'd like to hear Jeannie read some from her previous book, published by University of Illinois Press, called A Deed to the Light, you may go to will.illinois.edu, go to AM and look for Keeping the Faith, or you can just type in the little search box there, Jeannie Walker, and it'll pop right up, and you'll be able to hear that program at your convenience. And if you missed part of this program and would like to hear the beginning, or if you can't hear the end today, you can always go to our archives at will.illinois.edu. Jeannie Walker is a professor at the University of Delaware and author of now 7 books of poetry. She's received in the past a Pew Fellowship in the Arts and received an NEA fellowship and an Atlantic Monthly fellowship at Breadloaf School of English, and is a widely published poet. Many of the poems in this book, Jeannie, were previously published in journals and magazines, and you have a kind note at the end, thanking editors who printed your things, and some of which you say became your friends. I notice that some of these have been published in the Anglican Theological Review, the Christian Century, Commonweal. So you've been published by Protestant, Catholic, and Anglican publications, as well as secular places like Poetry Magazine and other places. Is this collection taken more from religious journals than ever before?
I think that this, collection is... it may be a little bit more of overtly questioning: who are we? What are we? How do we reach belief? Than some of my other volumes have. As I look back, each of the volumes has a kind of preoccupation, you might say, or an obsession. Each of the volumes is concerned with a kind of subject. I wrote one of the volumes, for example, when I was having a child, and I wrote it about the birth of a child. I wrote it about the process of bearing a child into the world and what it means to do that. So each of the volumes, and that's called Coming into History, because it's both a biological, incredibly complicated and mysterious and wonderful process, having a child, and totally inexplicable, even to the person it's happening to. But it's also a kind of it's a process of civilization, of, bearing somebody into history. It's a new child. It's a new identity. And so that was the obsession with that book. This book is really more about spiritual questions. It's wrestling and trying to come to terms with questions of belief.
I noticed last month you had a new poem in the Christian Century Easter Week. Came out in the April 7th edition. I thought I might read that myself. Would you mind if I did that?
I would love it if you did it.
A poem by Jeannie Murray Walker that was published in the Christian Century a month ago called Easter Week. Speaking of Houdini and escape of spring, this spring, there being no general or eternal spring, yesterday I saw a blue pickup pull out from a stoplight with 8 trees swaying and gesturing, sentenced to a life they never chose. We know the cruelty of mathematics, the bottom line, how it can cancel the exactitude of longing, how bereavement can sound like the plunking of a piano tuner through an open window, notes trying to break free, but staked to the tonic scale like greyhounds tethered to a doghouse in the killing heat of summer. As the truck accelerates, the wind ruffles the tree's feathers. They could be 5-year-olds in an Easter pageant, trying to slough off wings and other baggage. They are that filled with the Holy Ghost. Oh, the odd beauty of green. Oh, the rumor of another life. The poem Easter Week by Jeannie Murray Walker, published in the Christian Century about a month ago. How do you decide where to send things?
Well, that's a good question. I read the magazines that I send to. I actually like them, and I learn a great deal, by reading the other poems in those magazines, in journals. So I always I always think if you love the poetry in the journals, in a journal, then you have some shot that the editor will take your work, because the editor, because there is an affinity there, there's a kind of community there. So I think finally journal editors are writing for more or less defined group, probably less defined. I think, you know, it'd be very difficult to say exactly who they are, but there is a community of readers for each journal. No two journals has exactly the same community, but if you find yourself in that community of people who really like to read the journal, you're much more likely to be accepted, I should think, by the editor.
We're about halfway through our program today on Keeping the Faith. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, a broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. Today we're talking with Jeannie Murray Walker about her new book, New Tracks, Night Falling, a collection of her recent poetry. One of those poems was selected for Best American Poetry 2009. We'll be getting back to her in just a moment. Let me take a minute just to let listeners know what's coming up here in the weeks ahead on Keeping the Faith. Next week we'll be talking with two guests, two musical guests, Jean Redpath, the famous singer of Scottish traditional songs and many other types of music, and Julie Byler, a noted conductor of choral music. And we'll be talking about the value of music, the singing voice alone and together, solos and groups and choirs. That's next week on Keeping the Faith. On May 17, our topic will be talking with a guest representing the Amish community here locally. We're not exactly sure who we're going to have at this point, but we hope that will be our topic. And then we'll be talking on the 24th of May about Mormons and anti-Mormons, and our intern, Carly Nix, will be hosting that program. Those are some of the folks coming up here on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. Let me give the phone numbers again. We're eager to have listeners call with a question for our guest. If you'd like to call, if it's long distance, perhaps you're listening online, anywhere you can hear the program, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. That's a toll-free number, of course. Local callers may reach several local lines at 333-9455. Our technical director, Kyle Crowley, will answer the phone and put you in the queue to get on the air. And we're delighted to have listeners who make comments or ask questions. Of course, we're happy to have them just listen to. And I realize a program like this, that may be the most important pleasure. Let's ask Jeannie Murray Walker to read again one of her poems from her new book, New Tracks, Night Falling, published by Erdmans. What else do you have for us?
Well, you talked about driving, and I do quite a lot of driving, as we said. This is a poem about that. It's called Gift, and it is about the loneliness of driving alone in a car, but also the community, because there are cars around you. Each of us is in a little bubble. So it's called Gift. For 100 miles, the fields have worn beards of ugly stubble, and night is falling, and you can't find a lover. Not on AM or FM. And the hand at the toll booth wears a glove so as not to touch you. You pay for yourself, then for the car behind you. So someone pushing headlights through the heavy dark will feel luck go off like a Roman candle. So she'll give a car length to the maniac who cuts her off. And you, there in your lonely bubble, can think of each taillight, each anonymous fender, as a friend.
The poem Gift, read by Jeannie Murray Walker, the poet, found in New Tracks' Night Falling, her newest book. So, Jeannie, let me tell you what I thought when I first read that poem. I guess it's been a few weeks ago now, but I have this perverse mind, I'm afraid, sometimes, and I thought of the toll booth person with his or her rubber glove on, just pocketing that money and then taking it again from the person behind you.
Well, yes, so, that might have happened. I think...
poets just can't control what their readers may be thinking, can they?
No. No, that's absolutely right. No, it could have happened. I think that what... This actually happened. I actually did this. And I did it because I wanted to... You know, it just seemed like it would be an interesting experiment to see how I felt about the cars around me after I did that. And don't they have to ring something up on their little cash registers or something? I don't know. But maybe it didn't work. But I think the toll booth taker was so astonished by having this happen. You know, that's my vision of what might have happened, that the woman at the toll booth was so surprised that she went ahead and let the next car through.
You talk in your preface to this volume about the differences between people and the differences between the rich and the poor and the rich getting richer and so on in this culture. I have a friend who tries to think, who will be the poorest person I might meet today, and how might I be of direct help to that person? Will it be the person who cleans up the room after I leave a hotel? Will it be a person at a checkout counter? Who will it be? Someone who delivers my paper? And is there any way I can, without making that person feel bad, help their life, or do I need to be more, this person also thinks they should affect politics and make big decisions, but they like the idea of doing something personal. Does that idea appeal to you as well?
Well, it is, yes. I mean, I think that's where we live. I imagine that doing something for somebody else has an effect on me as well as on the other person. That it's not a bad idea to do that because somehow it makes me feel better about the world and myself. So, it feels very different from simply voting, which I do. But I think it's a very difficult problem because these people are separated from us. We don't know. I mean, if you say, for example, the person who checks you out at a hotel, you don't know who that person is. You don't, even if you may be standing at the counter and seeing the person, you don't really have a connection with the person except for that one economic connection that you've got. And it's just an incredibly difficult issue. I don't really know what to do about it, except I think not stepping over somebody on the sidewalk who's begging or, you know, trying to meet them in some way might be a way to do it. But if you're downtown, if you're, you know, encountering somebody, we have a friend who was actually here last night who runs a homeless shelter in Center City, Philadelphia. And Ed says one of the problems that the population that he sees has is everybody averts his or her eyes. Everybody steps around them. Everybody behaves as if they're invisible. And their reaction frequently comes from that kind of overwhelming response from the outside world. So I don't know what to do about that, but I think it's a very difficult problem, yeah.
You talked about your early moment of deconversion, you called it, from your fundamentalist background. Have you had, in times and years since, moments of reconversion?
Well,
to something?
An interesting question. For me, right now, I would say that conversion is a very slow, painstaking process.
Mm.
And it has to do with many small decisions rather than one hour of decision or moment of choice. And I think it's different for different people. But it may be fairly common for conversion to be slow. I think it may be more like what happens with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you wake up in the morning and you try to be grateful for the day, and you try to be thankful, whether you feel thankful or not, and you struggle to behave decently and to believe. You know, it's actually one day at a time and one moment at a time, and that's a very humble point of view, but we're human. Or, you know, I just feel so keenly that anything can happen in the next moment. We're not given anything but the moment we're living in right now, really. And it's that moment when we're making the decision about what we're going to be and what we're going to do and who we are and whether we believe. And I actually do believe that there is a great and wonderful providence that saves us. And you know, if I cut myself slicing onions, it's going to heal. And that, to me, is a great proof or evidence that there is, the world is orderly, and it is about healing, you know, at some very basic level. But I don't, it, for me, it's not all about one choice anymore. You know, if something happened in the past and it's now over, or, you know, it's really much more about every day.
You say in the preface to this volume, poems are not, as many people fear, hieroglyphics that are hopelessly indecipherable by all but a few readers. And they're not some elaborate system of double talk which has been designed to hide meaning. Why is it that people are afraid of poetry and stay away from it?
Well, I don't know why that is. It's interesting because I think most people speak in metaphor, that it's the most natural thing in the world. In fact, most clichés are metaphor that we use over and over and over. So that is, it's metaphor that's been used so many times that we don't even see that it's metaphor anymore. If you stop to think about the expression, for example, of all of his hopes went south, it means he lost his hope. You know, and I think we human beings tend to talk in metaphor, and that's, metaphor is what poems, how poems express themselves. It's pretty condensed, so you have to read a poem three or four times. But, and there have been poets fairly recently who are quite difficult to read. I just taught the modernist period with Wallace Stevens, for example, and T.S. Eliot, and some of their work is just incredibly difficult, and maybe unsayable in any other way. But if that is kind of the standard of what people are thinking about is poetry, then maybe they get scared, they get worried. But poetry right now is quite accessible. A lot of it is quite accessible, I think. And there is an increasing amount of kind of readership for poetry, poetry slams, poetry out loud in many of the states. Students in high school are reciting poems, memorizing and reciting poems, and they're fabulous. They're just very exciting, these competitions where the kids are reciting. And there are more and more poetry readings. I give poetry readings fairly often. I've just come back from Portland where I was doing a reading. So I think maybe people are realizing poetry is really necessary at some level, that you need to get away from the technical and get away from the bottom line, which is essential too. I mean, we need to have that. But that we need to have moments of refreshment, either with music or with poetry or ballet or theater or something like that. It's what keeps us in touch with ourselves, who we are, and it helps to give us a roadmap to our inside, our feelings, and our relationships with people.
Since I retired, I've been a mentor for a fourth grade boy, and we were talking last week about how rap music, the words, our poems, and talking about what some of those poems that people hear on the radio are saying. And people often forget that most music is, the words are poems.
Right.
May not be great poems, but.
Yeah, no, I think that that's right, and there are some lyrics of songs that are just deeply, deeply moving, and that's, in some ways, that's what poetry is too. It uses sound, like almost like music, a lot of poetry. So, yeah, I think that's right. I think this new generation may be a little more connected to poetry than some of us who are a little bit older.
In your preface, and again, this is an unusual book for you, and the editor publisher did ask you to write a preface for it. You talk in one place about one of your sections being about signs and inklings, those tracks in the snow that may lead to resolutions. How do you become sensitive to those things?
Well, you look. I think that my life is pretty fast. I can imagine that many of your listeners live lives that are even faster than mine. I'm not in the business world. I am teaching and several programs and flying to do readings, but our lives are so busy that I think we don't really look very carefully and things are a blur. But if you look very carefully, if you patiently look, I think you can see those signs. One of the things that I did was to intentionally install a bird feeder outside my office, so that I can see the birds. And I can see a sparrow at the moment at the bird feeder. We are still feeding them here in Philadelphia. And I sometimes sit and just look at the birds for half an hour as an exercise in self-control. And if the email, little ping from the email goes off, I ignore it. And I just think it is possible to slow down for very brief periods of time and pay attention, and that if you do that, you'll be rewarded. Maybe not at first, but slowly you feel aware and connected to what's around you and the meanings of those things, because things have meanings. They're hieroglyphs. They're signs.
I realize how very fortunate we are on this program, on this regional NPR station, to be able to slow down and take a whole hour talking with one author and hear her read several of her poems. I'm going to ask Jeannie to read another one before we get too close to the end. But I know how unusual it is, particularly with our busy lives, to be able to slow down like this and concentrate and listen and be moved. I'm asking Jeannie Murray Walker to read another poem from her new book, New Tracks, Night Falling, published by Erdmans this year, 2009. What have you selected?
Well, I think I'll read Little Blessing for My Floater. Most of your listeners probably know what a floater is. It's what happens to your eye, or one of your eyes, or both of your eyes, after you get to be about 35 or 40 years old. You might get a little speck that appears in your vision, and it's a place where your vision is actually interrupted. It looks like, when you're looking out at the world, it looks like a little black spot. And these floaters are alarming at first, because they damage your vision, but very quickly your mind gets so that it can repair the picture that you're seeing, and you don't even see the floater at all. So I remember when I first had a floater appear in my eye, and then it began to dawn on me that this was like a sign, this was like a ruined vision, which might actually be worth something. This is called Little Blessing for My Floater. This tiny ruin in my eye, small flaw in the fabric, little speck of blood in the egg, deep chip in the windshield, North Star, Pole Star, floater that doesn't float, spot where my hand is not, little piton nailing every rock I see. No matter if that image turns to sand or sand to sea, I embrace you, piece of absence that reminds me what I will be. All dark someday, unless God rescues me. Oh, speck that might still teach me how to see.
Read by Jeannie Murray Walker, her poem, Little Blessing for My Floater. You mentioned this is after George Herbert. Does it make you nervous as a contemporary writer knowing the history of poetry?
Oh, man, does it ever make me nervous. You know, Harold Bloom has talked about the anxiety of influence. And I think at some point you just throw the whole deck of cards down and say, I'm just never going to be Shakespeare. I mean, this is just, I'm never going to be George Herbert. I just got to do what I can, you know. But yes, such an amazing writer is George Herbert. So personal. And yet so formal. There's a kind of metrical formality and a kind of rhyming formality about his verse. But it feels as if he's talking just to you when you read his work. It's pretty incredible. And you just know you're not going to be able to do anything like that. You just have to try to work with what you've got, your own gifts and your voice.
And your own experience, talking in this poem about this little ruin in my eye, this speck in your eye, speck of blood in the egg, you call it, the sounds in this poem that keep reminding you of seeing, and the simple words you choose, and yet to write about something very, very important.
Well, I think what poetry does, excuse me, in a way, what poetry does is it takes something very, very, very simple and like a grain of sand and sees the whole universe in it and sees the space between the stars in this little grain of sand. The miracle is that we can take something which is real specific and generalize from it. So I think that's what this poem does too.
And in this poem where you specifically mention God, you say, "All this reminds me what I will be, all dark someday unless God rescues me." You don't find many statements of faith in contemporary poetry in my experience, but this seems to be one.
Well, I think my sense of dependency of it's very difficult to know where your life comes from or where your next breath is coming from. I mean, on the one hand, we're I suppose, by the time you get to be my age, you're kind of used to it. You're used to being alive and used to breathing and used to having the blood course through your veins, and you're just, you know, kind of, that's the normal course of things. I have by now experienced enough death around me and enough kind of sickness and so forth to be quite humble about the fact that I'm alive and deeply, deeply grateful. You know, and I think it may be a kind of metaphor, the fact that our lives are literally dependent on what we know not, but the great power in the universe. And so that's the first kind of level of needing to be rescued. It's not a given.
We will let that be the last words for this program from our guest today, Jeannie Murray Walker. We are out of time. We've enjoyed talking with her and hearing her read her poems from New Tracks, Night Falling, published by Erdmans this year in 2009. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs here on WILL 580 AM, 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, Illinois Public Media, a broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Next week, we'll be talking with Scottish singer Jean Redpath, live on the air with local choral director Julie Byler. The value of music will be our topic, the singing voice, alone and together. Then a program the following week on the Amish community, the 24th of May, Mormons and Anti-Mormons, with Carly Nix, our radio intern, hosting that program. Laura Dean Friedrich will be our guest May 31st, talking about advocacy for children. Those are some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith. We're always eager to have listeners participate, and if you'd like to listen at your own convenience, at your own time, do go to our website, will.illinois.edu, click on AM, and then go to Keeping the Faith, and you'll see the programs listed by date, or you may put in one of the guests' name in the search engine there and find what you can listen to on your computer. But thanks for listening today, live and on the air, to Keeping the Faith.
Keeping the Faith is made possible in part by the Quaker Meeting of Champaign-Urbana, a local community dedicated to the Quakers' testimony of peace, equality, integrity, and simplicity. The weekly meeting includes silent worship Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. at 1904 East Main Street in Urbana. Online at quaker.org/urbana.
John Cheever was sometimes called the Chekhov of the suburbs. Cheever's characters often find themselves struggling with issues of conformity and class in American suburbia, much like their creator himself. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll explore the life and work of John Cheever with his biographer, Blake Bailey. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
This evening at 7.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.